All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Gym Fear 138 podcast. Today, we have a very special guest, Brian Niemeyer, the man himself, the savior of science fiction, back to talk about his new Indiegogo. It is Indiegogo, right?
It is.
Cool. His Indiegogo for his new mecha novel, Combat Frame Exceed Coalition Year 40. So, Brian, welcome back to the show, man. Thanks for coming back on.
Thanks for having me. I'll always have a great time.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. So, the new novel, I assume the last one went off without a hitch?
The last Indiegogo campaign went off great. We ended up making four times the initial goal if you count in-kind contributions, which I do.
How do you mean by in-kind contributions?
Non-monetary ones that weren't through Indiegogo. So I had other people approach me and say, hey, you know, I really can't spare the change for this, but tell you what, I'll donate some services to help with the publishing.
Oh, so like, you know, I'll beta read for free or something?
Stuff like that.
Okay.
Art, yeah. We had two outstanding artists, Todd Everhart and Art Anon, working on the project. Great to have them. We're turning out some great new stuff for you guys that we're going to be revealing on social media, my Twitter, Facebook, and my blog. For the two backers who graciously contributed to build their own mechs.
Yeah, I was looking at this while I was recording my podcast for this week the other day, and I was just giving a little plug for it and looking at the different tiers that you had here, and I noticed that the bottom two were already taken. Three people have already claimed to be in the book, and two people wanted to build a mech, so I can't wait to see what those look like.
Oh, I don't want to spoil anything, but I was just communicating with Art Anon earlier today, and he showed me some sketches, and they're wild. I really don't want to spoil anything, but
For the people who design their own,
yeah, which are canonical. When you get that perk, I put them in the books.
Oh, it's not like a short story off to the side. It's in the book.
Or the first one actually was in the short story that bridges books 1 and 2, but I did a professionally produced ebook with its own cover for that. And DJ Schreffler, our first Build-A-Mech backer, is just all kinds of excited.
Hell, I would
with
be.
His initial. Yeah, he loves it. It's his avatar now.
Yeah. I can't say I blame the guy. I mean, you know, you get two great artists like you've got. I know Art Anon wants to remain anonymous for a while yet, but Todd Everhart's just amazing. You said he did the cover before we started recording, right?
Yeah, he's done all three covers. He did the cover for Combat Frame Exceed. He did the cover for the short story, The Bridge's first two novels, Combat Frame Exceed, CY2 Gaiden. He did the cover for Combat Frame Exceed Coalition Year 40, and he's engaged to do all of them.
So yeah, and if you like the cover, just a free plug for Todd, if you like the covers that he's doing for Brian's work, you can find him on Twitter at Rollcasters, and I'll put a link down in the description to his Twitter profile so you can find him. So, whole new novel. Is it okay to talk spoilers about what happened in between the first two novels, or?
Sure, we can do some. I will say that if your listeners want the full story, they can get it in the aforementioned Combat Frame Exceed CY2 Gaiden, which is available through a special link at the back of the first ebook, and you'll get the short story for free. And sign up for Nova Frontier, which is my exclusive Combat Frame Exceed newsletter, where I give out special inside dirt, special offers, special deals to our small but growing cadre of subscribers, and we have a great time there as well.
Yeah, so you're kind of doing the Galaxy's Edge thing with the Galactic Outlaws.
Yeah, exactly.
So it sounds like a good plan. It seems to be working, because I remember you had contacted me about doing the podcast, and I had some shit to do in real life that held me up for a while, but I went and checked it when we were setting up the date for this, and you were already funded. Like, the thing is already funded. It's happening. But there's still a whole lot of tears open and stuff like that. So
yeah, I can't stop it. It's going to happen.
It seems to be growing. I don't know if exponentially is the right word because I'm not a math guy, but it seems that there is a hunger for this kind of stuff out there.
Yeah, that's one of the main reasons I did it. I wanted something that was a little more accessible, less heady than the Soul Cycle. Much as I love that series, I think you'll agree it's crazy fun with an emphasis on the crazy. But yeah, Mil SF is hot, but then the mech genre, like the real robot genre, which is my favorite subset of Mil SF, is kind of down at heel right now. It's stuck in a bunch of trope traps and self-referential loops.
Yeah, it's a damn shame too, because you know, I like being in that DM group is just like seeing all of the different mech shows that I never knew existed. Because for me back in the day, it was like Zoids and Gundam, of course, and like Big O and maybe a couple of other shows that actually did the mech thing, and of course, like, you know, Voltron and Power Rangers and stuff like that. But like, I never knew about stuff like Getter Robo and Gal Gaigar, and now I've got just this huge list of mech shows that I need to go watch. This stuff used to be so popular right up until like the turn of the century, basically, and then for some reason mech stuff just fell off.
Yeah, there are other folks that you and I know, guys like you know, Ron Baral on Twitter and the Pulp Archivist and J.D. Cowan, who have made more of a study about exactly what happened. But I think, as we discussed before, Neon Genesis Evangelion was one of the big kill shots that everything has been aping since, at least in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then just the dominance of Macross and Gundam, which have just been playing it safe for a couple decades now and just repeating that, you know, now it's time for the Neo Zeon War. Popcorn. They're too risk averse. And so I decided, you know what? I'm going to take Nicole's advice. I'm going to write what I love, but with an eye toward breaking through these dead ends, to which both Mil SF, to a lesser extent, but mainly Mecha, have devolved. And based on the reviews of the first book, I've succeeded. But I'm not blowing my own horn here. You can go check them out.
No, I believe you. I mean, if anybody can save the mecha genre, it's probably the guy who wrote the Soul Cycle. So,
no pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. It's just an entire genre of literature and anime, but it's coming along. I see you're even doing like trading cards for this one. Did you do that for the last book? Or
yeah, I did. They were really popular. They were our first stretch goal. And we got those funded. I put those out. People loved them. But I ordered more than I needed because, well, printing places require pretty high minimum orders. So they're still available. The first run is as perks for the current Indiegogo campaign.
Okay. That's pretty badass.
Yeah, and we're just like $150 or less from unlocking a second run of trading cards, which is our stretch goal for the CY40 campaign. So I urge your listeners to go and grab a perk. I mean, I think it would only take like 3 paperbacks at this point to fund the new trading cards. And these are going to be designed by Todd.
Okay.
Yeah, this series is going to feature the 4 X-Seeds that are the main mecha in Coalition Year 40.
Okay. So about the trading cards, is it just like baseball cards? Like you just have the card and it's just like something nice to look at? Or is it like actually a game? Can you like use these things to fight with like damage counters and stuff like Pokemon or Digimon cards? I'm showing my age with the Digimon cards.
That's fine. They're actually incredibly useful, I've been told by readers, because on the front, you have a nice slick picture of the mech with its name and affiliation. And then on the back, I give its stats. But they're not necessarily game stats. They're in the format of Burke's All the World's Mobile Weapons that a couple of mech fan sites like MAHQ and now Gundam Official use. Which, if you're not familiar with that, it's the same style that Jane's Defense Weekly gives for real-world fighter craft.
Okay.
So it gives like armor material and dry weight and full weight and kilograms of thrust of its engines and the wattage output of its generator and little tidbits like that. So what people like to do is, I found it was popular, was folks would get the trading card paperback bundle, use the trading cards for bookmarks, first of all. They're very good for, they're very sturdy, but then also, if you're reading a mech fight, they're handy because you can just have the book open in one hand and the trading card with the mechs involved in the other, and is kind of a scorecard. You know, you can use them as a reference in the fight. So, you know, oh, okay, well, this one's faster, so it'll be quicker on the draw, but this one has more power.
Okay.
People tend to nerd out like that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the Mech Warrior video game for this.
I'll need to, one step at a time. You know, perhaps if we had like a $5 million goal, but baby steps. In the meantime, I'm still hoping that you'll agree to do an audiobook of the first volume and sing the theme song if we hit $5,000.
I did say I would. Like I say, it might not be pretty, but you know, I'll do it and then I'll let you decide if you want to use it or not.
We'll let the readers decide. So there you go, folks. Jim Fear 138 confirmed for the 500% funded tier.
Yeah, if we get up that high, if we get it up that high, I'll do the, not only will I do the audiobook, but I will sing the theme song. That might be bonus material, and then he'll get someone who actually knows what they're fucking doing to do the real version of the theme song. But
well, I believe in you. We came close last time, and we're actually doing a little better this time. The per cap contribution per backer is up a few cents. And we're at the halfway mark right now. The campaign is halfway over, and we've raised a little more than halfway to the previous goal, or the previous high watermark. So we'll see. And there are a couple of big ticket items.
It's only been up left for a week, hasn't it?
Nah, it's been up for two.
Two
time
weeks?
Flies.
Two, damn, okay.
That's... Yeah, I said it for a month, and it's halfway over.
That's still really impressive that you're, you know, halfway into it and you're already halfway to the watermark from the last one. So, you know, if the hype keeps up, which hopefully it will, you could easily top your last campaign.
Yeah, I'm doing my best out there, and I've given my eye on those two platinum level perks. And it's interesting you mentioned a short story before, because the big one, like the diamond tier, for $1,000, you can commission me to write you your very own short story featuring the character and topic of your choice. I suggest that it be a character from either the Soul Cycle or even my short stories or Comet Frame Exceed in my, you know, existing catalog. But if you also want to get the custom character perk, or the Be Killed in a Book, which let you create characters, you can then use them in your personal short story.
Okay.
So I'll let it be about you or character you create then. But then I will get a professional cover and format it and release it on Amazon as a professional ebook. And of course you get a contributor copy, but you'll be immortalized in the canon of the Soul Cycle or Comet Frame Exceed by me. Have a short story to enjoy and cherish for your lifetime and beyond.
So it's just for either the Soul Cycle or Combat Frame Exceed. It's not like like someone wouldn't be able to buy this and then screw with you and say, I want you to write a mech fight between Amuro and Char.
Well, for the $1,000 one, you couldn't, because I don't own those characters.
Okay. So you wouldn't be able to sell that. Like that would be something that you would have to put up on like Archive of Our Own or something like that. You wouldn't actually be able to make any money off of that.
Yeah, couldn't sell it. However, I would consider it for the $500 tier, which is the personal short story where I do everything I mentioned above, but I don't sell it and I don't get it a cover.
Okay.
Like the $500 difference between the two is basically for the cover.
Makes sense, because I mean, art, like, I know art isn't cheap, so.
Exactly.
Especially when you have really talented artists who know what they're worth and know that the market for most art on the internet is just complete shit. It's ridiculous how low people are selling their skills out there.
Well, you know, that's the market for you. But I have a feeling that there's some good guys on white horses out there, some heroes who are lurking and biding their time and watching this campaign and are waiting until the last minute to swoop in and get one of those two. So we'll see. I got a hunch.
Let's hope so. I mean, you already have a certain level of popularity with the Soul Cycle, the success that had, and then now there's this whole new thing that nobody else is doing apart from, so far as I know, a couple of other people in the Pulp Rev, Bradford Walker, Raul Nianzi, I think JD and Kess are planning their own things, but I don't think they've actually done anything with it yet.
And my buddy Edamlane Smith is also planning it.
Oh yeah, Brometheus.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brometheus is also planning a Gundam for Us story.
Yeah, Exceed was just the first of the punch, partially due to some extenuating circumstances. But I've got an unfair edge in that I'm just a professional author and editor for a living, so I can devote darn near 100% of my time to this.
I can see how that would help you out in getting ahead of the curve a little bit. So let's talk about the actual story itself. So we were going to talk spoilers about the in-between story, but I don't remember if we ever got to that.
No, we can do a little. I don't want to
just a little bird's eye view kind of thing of what happens in between the two books and then on to the next one.
Sure. Should we do a brief overview of the first book in case we got some new people who didn't hear the last show?
It might be helpful, but for those people who didn't hear it, I will put a link to the last show in the description.
Very good. Okay. So, really quick synopsis. The world of Combat Frame Exceed starts from our own timeline. It speculates on, okay, what happens if all of the social, environmental, economic, moral crises besetting us today come to a head sometime in the coming century? And what ends up happening is the elite flee the Earth, build clusters of huge space colonies at the Earth-Moon Lagrange points between the Earth and the Moon. And meanwhile, life on Earth just devolves to almost Mad Max levels and slowly builds itself back up. After a long span of time, a century or more, life in outer space stabilizes where the space colonists don't have to worry about just bare survival. So they look back at Earth oh, good Lord, we need to help these people get back into our level. So they send relief workers to intervene, but the people on Earth, who are derogatorily called grounders, see the colonists as meddlers and are rather mean to them. They act rather violently to their attempts to elevate them. So a guy in the colonies who works under the moniker of Tesla Browning says, hey, I just strapped a minigun onto this Ripley-style space exosuit construction equipment. How about we mass-produce these? That should solve the security problem on Earth right quick. And Fulton's like, good idea. So the colonies band together into the systems over a terrestrial coalition with a mandate to recivilize the Earth. They send these manned 50-foot-tall robots called Combat Frames to put the grounders in their place. Hilarity ensues. But disparate elements within the coalition start a cloak and dagger game of dog eat dog to wrest power away from the current, more placid administration. There's a series of double crosses, and somebody truly genocidal ends up taking the reins of the most powerful and wealthiest government in human history, attempts to just sterilize the Earth, and obviously doesn't succeed. I'm not going to tell you how, because there'd be no stories after that. It's really close. Actually, let's say does and doesn't succeed. Let's put it that way.
He comes just close enough where you could look at it and go, did we really beat him?
Yeah. So, and the end game involves the emergence of strong AI and also the creation of the eponymous X-Seeds, which are like the Ferraris of combat frames. They're just these, like, just most advanced, most powerful. Okay, so as part of the story, the dictator who seizes control of the coalition changes the calendar and says, right, we are now going to date everything from this year. This year is CY1.
Okay.
That's where the title comes from.
Kind of doing a French Revolution thing.
Yeah. Well, what this person says is, like, to mark this current and final year, because, again, trying to wipe out the Earth. So there's only ever supposed to be one CY year, but here we are. So now in Coalition Year 2, we follow some of the survivors from the first book who head back to Earth to mop up this one rogue coalition governor who, in the chaos, seized control of Western Europe. And he's got a hold of the former German Republic's nuclear arsenal and is using that to consolidate his power base and spread it throughout Europe. Meanwhile, Nouvelle-France is controlled by one of the most popular characters from the first book, Jean-Claude Dulion. And so we're back to the old problem of the Germans trying to invade France and the French fighting back, only with giant robots this time.
I can get behind World War II with giant robots.
Yeah. So we basically got that, and they're at a stalemate. But coalition-controlled Germany, basically, they're going to win on the margins. They've got more people, bigger industrial base, nukes, etc. But into this comes Todd Ritter. And he returns to fulfill his goal of taking back Deutschland from the coalition and enacts a daring plan to do so. Prem Nariol, who's now coalition secretary general, really doesn't like the idea of an independent and nuclear-armed Germany in anyone's hands. So she goes to desperate lengths to prevent that by dredging up a certain character with a certain combat frame who were MIA and thought dead at the end of the last book. But it turns out through the intervention of some of the fanatics left over from the army of the deposed dictator is back and comes to loggerheads with Todd in an explosive finale that changes the course of CY history forever. So I can tell you that at the end of CY2, we basically have any obstacles to the coalition's complete dominance of the globe removed. So Nariol and her coalition are on the march to achieve the SOC's initial goal of re-civilizing the Earth, basically by dominating it. And you have this ragtag, small group of dissenters who have gone into exile in space, but it turns out they have found a patron who is willing to give technical and financial support to their plan to eventually return and free the Earth. But because they're starting from square one again, it's going to take time. And it turns out 40 years, in fact, because then we pick up with my current project, Combat Frame X-Seed, Coalition Year 40. Does that, think that gets people up to speed okay? Any questions?
I think so. I'm all right, because I don't want you to give away more than you want to give away from this. And I do actually want people to go and read the books. So I think we're good and up to speed for now.
Right on. shall we discuss the second book? Just dive right into that.
Definitely.
Okay. Time frame exceed culture year 40. In contrast to the first book, which I describe as Mobile Suit Gundam meets Tom Clancy, is Gundam Wing meets Ender's Game.
Okay. That, you got my attention. So.
Yeah, whereas in the first book, I kind of took the basic plot from MS Gundam and just turned it inside out, just inverted it. This time, I'm doing my homage to Gundam Wing, but adding in a highly personalized revenge plot. In fact, multiple revenge plots. Because after the events of the first book and the CY2 Gaiden short story, there are a lot of people with serious axes to grind against the Sox.
It sounds like it from here.
Yeah, because one of the ways that they finally established dominance over the Earth was they realized, well, we could keep just sending men and equipment to Earth to fight this perma-war. Or, you know what? We have exclusive control of outer space, and, oh, gee whiz, someone has conveniently left a massive debris field from an exploded asteroid over the Earth. So all we really have to do is kind of curtail our cleanup efforts and just let certain of those rocks get pulled in and drop on the world's bread baskets and starve out our enemies.
All right, so kind of doing the Brianna Wu strategy.
Apparently. But no, it's a solid strategy because, okay, if you go in shooting your guns everywhere, knocking over your opponent's statues, inherent limitations of the women, you create a certain subset of the population who is just hell-bent on revenge and will come back at you again and again until they're dead. So a man who has had his city walls thrown down, had his father's ashes and his god's temples broken and profaned, will carry a vendetta. If, however, you set up a siege, if you are dealing with a starving man, see, an angry man will keep coming at you. A starving man will welcome you when you show up and say, here are sandwiches and smokes. So that's what the Coalition did.
Okay. So they did they, like, make it look like an accident, or?
Oh, no.
Like that, so everybody on Earth knew that they were the ones that were throwing the rocks?
Absolutely, because they warned him, like, hey, like, submit to us and, like, accept our plan for Earth, or, like, we will decimate your major arable farmland with space rocks. And it was really only the Central American and Canadian states that said, up yours, we're going to fight to the last man. Like, okay, we just won't clean these rocks we were scheduled to clean up over North America after all, and just let gravity do its thing, and bye-bye Great Plains and breadbasket states. So
damn.
Yeah, nuclear winter as well. So everywhere else that could grow had a horrible growing season. So yeah, in comes global starvation. So of course you then got the other countries that were willing to sign on, angry at us for not backing down. The kind of Full Metal Jacket approach. Like, I'm not going to punish him. I'm going to punish you guys and let you punish him. So
basically, yeah. The rest of the world ties America down in a bed and starts beating him with soap wrapped up in towels.
Indeed. Except that the soap is also asteroids. But yeah. So eventually, yeah, they just starve us out. We're like, okay, we'll accept your control. And then Sox come in. They're like, okay, you know, being the space autists there, they're like, wow, some of your major population centers are really far from natural resource extraction areas and refineries. So what we're going to do is just let's play Sim Earth and let's clear the board. And, ooh, there's a copper deposit over there. So let's put in a mine and a refinery, and then we'll build a town to house the workers with a nice central administrative center in the middle for our functionaries and bureaucrats to oversee everything, and just repeat. So they just wholesale raised and relocated whole populations and moved ancient cities with no regard for their culture, history, architecture, or art. Just efficiency.
Damn.
And just put like these unimaginative gray grids all over the planet to extract resources.
That's pretty heavy. That's pretty heavy right there.
Yeah, which, I mean, also pissed off a lot of people remember the way things used to be.
Oh, yeah, I imagine. But, I mean, then again, yeah. Like, these guys seem to be playing, like, long games, so in 100 years, it's gonna have been this way forever, so far as everybody who's alive is concerned.
Yeah, exactly. They've got subtle privatized propaganda going to, like, every medium, you know, every movie, every pop song. It's like pro-coalition, and hey, let's all be friends and get together, and let's work together, and all that sappy stuff.
A little bit of 1984 meets They Live.
Yeah, exactly. Except the aliens aren't hiding. They don't think they have to, and they're wrong.
Because that group of what would they be called? Mercenaries, revolutionaries, or out in the ether somewhere, just waiting for the right time to strike.
Well, okay, I was just reading up about this as part of the novel research. So there are three kinds of resistance groups when a hostile power takes over territory. So what you can get in these circumstances are guerrillas, partisans, and insurgents. Okay?
All right.
And the main difference is with the first two, they are previously native occupants of the territory that's been invaded. And so they're fighting on the home front from inside. So like the Wolverines.
Yeah, I was about to say a Red Dawn type thing.
Yeah, the guys from Wolverines and Red Dawn are partisans.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, it's not guerrillas. It's militias, partisans, and insurgents. And so yeah, they're partisans. You know, they're citizens being thrust into the situation.
So this would also cover like the Warsaw Ghetto uprising in World War II.
Right.
Okay.
Then there are insurgents, which are guys from outside who are coming in and kind of taking the opportunity to push a rival agenda. So that'd be like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, those kinds of guys.
Right.
Yeah, they don't necessarily care about what the partisans and the militias care about. They're just looking to spread their thing. You know, the Sandinistas in South America would be another example.
Yeah, and then militias would be like remnants of the military, right?
Yeah, militias are regular. They can be remnants of the National Guard and stuff, but they're, you know, what our Constitution would define as militia, you know, men of fighting age who were citizens were armed. And yeah, that's the main difference between them and partisans. So what we've got going on here with Coalition Year 40 is sort of a weird hybrid of partisans and insurgents.
Hmm. Okay.
Just because the coalition is just taking a little population and flung people over hill and dale and just like deracinated everything. So where the story picks up is at the Brussels former Royal Military Academy, but now just the Brussels Service Academy, where the coalition trains its officers who are stationed on Earth. And they use the old campus of the current Belgian Royal Military Academy. But there you start to see the clear dichotomy between how the SOX and the Grounders are treated, because only SOX can actually become commissioned officers. Only they can hold jobs of any importance. So certain Grounders are allowed to go there, but they're stuck doing the jobs in the military that are like normal everyday jobs, but they have to wear uniforms and get yelled at more.
Okay, so the Grounders are doing like grunt work and actual like frontline combat, and the SOX, do they have to like be sent down from one of the colonies? Or can
not
it be
in this
like,
case.
Like somebody, like a couple of SOX got married and had a kid, and then he goes to this academy because he wants to be in the military.
Right, and that does happen in the book. And those people are given another derogatory name by the Sox of the Colonies. They are called Fel, just F-E-L.
Fel, okay. That's pretty cool. I like that.
Yeah, they say that the Fel are Sox born on Earth. So other Sox see them as kind of losing a bit of their pedigree, like a little refinement of having actually been from space. Right? And they're accused of being more grounder sympathetic, having grown up around them. But yeah, they can still become officer cadets and hold important jobs. But you know, now that the Coalition has been in the business of actually administering the Earth for 40 years or more, they're a lot of Fel. Because a lot of Sox have to live and work on Earth to oversee the grounders. But like I mentioned, they're still outnumbered by actual grounders that the Sox have to rely on, at least in some capacity, to make things work. But yeah, they're highly supervised by technology and by Sox. And yeah, they're limited to service positions. They can't be in leadership. They can't get the cushy cherry jobs.
Right, but somebody's got to clean the toilets.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, at the Brussels Academy, there is a history club. Now, the only people interested in the history club are the grounders, because, like I said, the Coalition has no sense of history. Right? You know, they think they're the end of history, like the Secretary General who named CY1 kind of embodied. So it's this basically grounder history club, but it's really a front for an underground resistance movement. Because the guy who is the faculty advisor to the history club is none other than EGE Colonel retired Alan Collins.
Okay.
Yeah, character from the first book.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So it's kind of got this, not the Warriors, this Wolverines kind of thing going on, where somebody, you know, who was involved in the thing comes back, and now he's working for the bad guys, and he's leading everybody. Okay.
So, yeah, it's actually a front for a campaign of blackmail, sabotage, and even some terrorism against the local Sox. So these guys, while working under the radar, managed to spark scandals that get a couple of governors removed from office. You know, snap, snap, nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of stuff. They're just able to come up the works because at least one of them has a job on the nearby airbase. Because the Sox have turned the Brussels International Airport into... they like basically attached a spaceport and military airbase onto it.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so it's kind of a power hub for the area. But the student group, the HLO, the Human Liberation Organization, just fucks with them. Yeah,
I love that name. I absolutely love that name.
Because implicit in it is that the Sox ain't human.
Exactly. Just like it says everything that you need to know. With just right there, three little letters.
Yeah. Now, Collins isn't actually their leader. He's just kind of their Obi-Wan. He's their sagacious conciliary and advisor. Their leader is this crazy 17-year-old asshole named Arthur.
All right.
Yeah, who you guys can, who've read the first book, the first chapter of Coalition Reform is available in the back, and it focuses on Arthur's brutal upbringing in the Colorado wilderness. In preparation to lead the HLO. It's also available on my website, briannewmeyer.com. There's a free preview. And also through the Indiegogo campaign link, I give two sample chapters of CY40. But with Arthur, he's basically raised from toddlerhood by just this tough as nails, stern, uncompromising EGE veteran in a cabin in the Rockies.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, and, you know, with the understanding that, okay, you know what? So you want to eat, you go out and kill it. You want to go explore your environment, that's fine. You know, go out there, build a house, paint a self-portrait. But here's the thing. Should you, like, be chasing down a rabbit and slip on a path and fall and, like, break your back, no one's coming for you. We'll get another one just like you. Thanks for playing.
Oof.
Yeah, so just okay, no so mercy.
This is where the Ender's Game thing comes in.
Yeah, and then one day, little Arthur is out there exploring his environment and climbing up to the peak of a mountain so he can see the impact craters from the Sock asteroids out across the plain beyond the foothills. He realizes, oh no, I'm going to be late if I don't get back right now. So he's just rushing headlong back down the path and manages to make it up onto the first step of like the hand-hewn log cabin he lives in with this crazy bastard, and realizes, oh no, I'm like 2 minutes late. You know, that's a padlet. So he goes in to face the music and instead finds the grizzly old dude he's been living with, who he knows only as the captain. That's the only form of address that knows this guy, but doesn't even know his name, is standing there holding a puppy. Like a bouncy, little curly-haired black puppy dog. And Arthur's overjoyed. He's like, oh, wow. And my first, not only plain companion, but the first sign of affection I've been shown in my life. This is great. And then the captain pulls out a gun and gestures over to the woman in the blue jumpsuit, bound and gagged, tied to a chair in the corner. And he just holds out the gun, looks to the gun, looks to the woman, looks to the dog, and Arthur understands the choice. So, takes the gun, realizing, like, either you use it on her, or I will use it on the dog.
Jesus.
And, well, it's helped along in making his decision, because at that point, his personality fragments into two.
Okay.
And we get the cold, calculating, ruthless Arthur, who is able to do what needs to be done. But then we get the friendly, outgoing, almost saccharine, sweet, ebullient Tom. So split some Tom Stormio and Arthur Wake. And the captain tells him, all right, look, we're going to be sending you to school soon to like live among the Grounders and the Sox. And you're going to need to be Tom most of the time. People can't know what you really are. But at the right times, you need to be able to let Arthur out because he can do what Tom can't. Enjoy your dog. Damn. Like, always be Tom around the dog. I'm not getting you another one.
That's nuts. So was the woman just like a sock? She was just like somebody that it didn't matter? Like,
yeah, she was a sock. She wasn't human. It was okay.
Yeah, okay. I gotcha.
So she was lower than the dog, and
they have that kind of psychological view of the Sox. Like, not only are they not human, they're like subhuman. These are like Morlocks.
They're bugs. They're ants.
Yeah, they're just like, we're better than them because we're Grounders, and you know, it's perfectly okay to do whatever you want to them whenever you want, as long as you can get away with it.
Yeah, it's imperative, in fact. It's a moral duty.
Oh, wow.
To do horrible things to them. Yeah. And that's where Arthur's coming from. Yeah, I wrote this book because, okay, I've been getting feedback about the first Combat Frame Maxine, and lots of people tell me, man, I hate the Coalition. I hate the Sox. I'm just itching for them to get theirs. And so I'm saying, okay, be careful what you wish for, because my prime goal in writing Coalition Year 40 and in writing Arthur specifically is to make the reader pity the Sox at least a little bit, at least a fleeting, like, oh, good Lord, I can't believe he did that.
Great. Great.
Let's put it this way.
Remember everybody who said that. You asked for this when you read this.
I wrote at least.
You asked for this.
I wrote at least one crucifixion scene. Let's put it that way.
Holy shit. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued. Not exactly surprised, because, I mean, you know, if you see people as less than human, like, why not? So,
yeah.
if that's the kind of mindset that you have, of course you would do horrible, terrible things to people, like crucify them and stuff like that. So, you know, it totally makes sense. And I'm glad that you're kind of turning it around, because in the first book, it really seemed like you were making the Sox just bastards. Just utter, complete bastards. Just there isn't one likable human being, like what we would consider a human being, like an affectionate, loving person with a soul. It's just all like psychopaths and monsters and marauders up there in the space stations. And now you get to put these people in some Saw situations, and it's like, oh shit.
Yeah.
You know, the reader has to stop and think, like, I was really hoping to see these guys get theirs, but not like this.
Yeah, basically that's it. And also, because the phenomenon of the Fell have emerged, you do have Sox in name who are colonists. They're citizens of the Coalition, but they were born, they lived on Earth their whole lives. And they do have more empathy. So there's one character, Bertha Sternemann, who is actually the daughter of the Coalition deputy governor of Western Europe, who is attending the academy to train to be a doctor. She wants to be a medic in the Coalition Defense Forces. And she does show concern for one character in particular, a grounder computer whiz named Simon Trent, who's only 15, but he was accepted to the Academy on a scholarship for his programming expertise. And he gets hazed and bullied by the sock jocks. And she actually tries to, if not necessarily intervene on his behalf, show some remorse and tells people, look, I'm sorry for that. I'm not like that. I don't see him any differently. So she does have a soul. She does have some redeeming qualities.
Okay.
But again, Arthur doesn't care.
But yeah, Arthur is not in the business of caring about what the Sox and the Fell think.
Right. He doesn't draw that line. He just sees Sox. So there's that conflict. But then, so you start with this utterly bloodthirsty, ruthless, calculating chess master. Okay, now throw in at least four giant advanced death machines that are nearly indestructible and carry lasers meant only to be used from orbit.
It sounds like a recipe for a fun time to me.
That's exactly what it is. Especially when they realize a laser can't be stopped. It probably shouldn't be fired horizontally in a city. Yeah, so the character.
That's brilliant. I cannot fucking wait to read that scene.
Yeah, the character, the pilot, as he sees what he's done, like a single tear rolls on his cheek, he goes, it can't be stopped.
Oh, you should not fire a laser horizontally in a city. Oh, God.
Not a 6-megawatt space laser, no.
No. This is like, you know, capital ship kind of weapon right here.
Well, I'd classify that more as anti-air or anti-armor, because we get to see the capital ship version.
Oh, okay. So it's not like... So the space, the Sox actually do have a navy. It's not just like, you know, they have the combat frames and then regular troops and then shuttles to get them back and forth from the colonies to Earth. They actually have like capital ships and fighters and things like that.
Yeah, they do. We get to see some of that. It's mentioned kind of offhand in the first book, partly in like the front and back matter, because I think that Tessel Brown even says something about a combat frame gives you power equivalent to a warship, but in a more compact form. So that was part of the justification for the rationale for building them. But no, they do have warships. They have destroyers and cruisers and carriers, and there are fighters. Like if you look on the Indiegogo page, there is an example of a fighter. Now, skirting around spoiler territory, if you read the first book, you know that the Coalition actually was behind creating the first X-Seeds. They were initially built to help eradicate mankind. But the good guys got a hold of at least one of them and turned it to good purpose. But there are also hints that the X-Seeds weren't the end of the line. They weren't meant to be the ultimate output of this genocidal program. There was something else that they were kind of the test beds for. And in Coalition Year 40, we get to find out what that was. And it turns out the four X-Seeds in the book were proposed targeting systems for this thing.
All right. That's intriguing.
So they're numbered the XCD 101, 102, 103, and 104.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they get their numbers is how close they came to being the final approved prototype of this targeting system. So the 101 is the targeting system. The 102 can serve in a pinch. It can take over for the 101 in that regard. And then the 103 and 104 were just kind of like essays in the craft.
Right, I gotcha.
But they can all completely flatten the major metropolitan area.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, just kind of basing off, like, knowledge of Gundam and stuff like that. Yeah, a Gundam can and has flattened major metropolitan areas. And if these things are roughly on the level of one of the more advanced Gundams from, like, Gundam Wing or something like that, then, yeah, I would kind of expect them to be able to go fucking hog on New York City and not really have a problem.
Yeah, they're a little bit worse, actually, and I honestly didn't set out at the beginning to do this, but I've been consulting with a couple physicists on, like, the weapons and armor technology, and the real world of science actually dictates this. We talked last time about carbine and graphene, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what the X-Seeds armor is made of. And just to give folks a quick recap, graphene is a 2D allotrope of carbon in like a hex pattern that is so tough that it takes the force of an elephant perched on a pencil to puncture it. But then it's also a superconductor. Then there's carbine, which is one-dimensional graphene. So it's a string of carbon atoms, just one atom thick. And it's even tougher. It's even more resilient. So the X-Seeds have 1D carbine armor in layers, like 100 layers. And with the Gundams and Gundam Wing are made of Gundanium alloy, which is ridiculously resilient against, like, conventional kinetic attacks. Like, you're really not going to find a bullet or a shell that's going to punch. But, like, everything in Gundam, they're still vulnerable to energy weapons like plasma, lasers, direct particle cannons, that kind of thing. That's kind of the Achilles heel of every mobile suit. Well, the X-Seeds found a way around that because graphene being a superconductor, it can bleed off like a third of the destructive force of an energy weapon contact into an onboard capacitor before the attack can do significant damage to the combat frame.
So it still gets hit, but it like charges its battery off of this stuff.
It gets hit. A third of the energy is lost, like to through like air resistance in the atmosphere or through the cooling effect of space. Then a third boils away one layer of carbine and the other third goes into the battery.
Okay, so it still does damage to them, but they have like all of these different layers of this stuff. So you would have to have like a Gatling laser or something to burn a Gatling laser and an afternoon and a 24 pack to burn through one of these things.
Yeah, you'd have to hit the same exact spot like 100 times to get through, just to get through the armor.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and they're just as resistant to kinetic weapons as Gundams are. So they're darn near indestructible. Now, the first generation of X seeds, the prototypes had a limitation in that.
And these are the X seeds. These aren't like the regular combat frames.
Right. These are only the X seeds.
Okay.
Gotcha. Yeah. So the 1D carbine armor is, at least for now, a defining feature of the X seed class. So the initial X seeds had a built-in limitation because they didn't really have time to refine it. And so, first of all, they can absorb pretty much any energy through their armor, including radar. So they were invisible to radars. They showed up as like a radar contact the size of like a quarter. But when their capacitor was full, if they couldn't absorb any more energy, they become visible to sensors. But then also, the only way for the first run of X seeds to bleed off energy in their capacitor was to shoot it through their main plasma weapon, which is highly visible. It gives away your position if you're shooting off a big old beam gun.
Yeah, I'd just say that make a scene.
Yeah, and while the capacitor is full, well then 60% of the energy of a energy weapon attack is directed against the armor instead of just 33. So 66 instead of 33.
Right.
So they become more vulnerable to energy weapon attacks. With what I'm calling the 1 series, so the 101 through 104, they got around that problem. So for one thing, their weapons are powered, they have the ability to be powered directly off of the X-Seed's internal generator as well as the capacitor, so they can drain their weapons. They can drain the capacitor both through their weapons, but they don't have to wait for their capacitor to charge before they can shoot. So they have basically unlimited ammo for the ones that shoot energy while still being able to absorb energy directed at them. And then also each one has its own kind of special means of bleeding off its capacitor to make room. So one can discharge all the energy in its capacitor in a massive broadcast EMP that can shut down any combat frame up to like a Grandsmark 3 and just fry grunts on the ground. Others just have like a thin hairline laser that they can just point out into space, like a microwave beam, and free up some energy in the battery. And unless it's pointed directly at you, you're never going to be able to detect it.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, then one
and
of them,
and that's real. You can actually do that, like in real life, right? If you had the equipment, you could do something like that right now.
According to my advisors, I mean, I'm not an expert, but according to my advisors, I mean, yeah, graphite arc conductor, you can make wicked high capacity batteries and capacitors by folding a graphene sheet. Gotta be careful if it comes unfolded involuntarily, though.
I would imagine that would hurt.
Yeah. But, yeah, you could definitely use a laser or microwave transmissions, like tight beams, to broadcast energy. So, I mean, that's been one proposed solution to our energy problems on Earth, I believe, is like having like solar collection satellites in orbit that then beam the power down to microwaves.
Hmm.
But the fun part for you is that it makes these things just ridiculously dangerous. They're super hard to kill, and they can not only dish out their own damage, but they can do judo jiu-jitsu. They can take the punishment you throw on them and just throw it right back at you.
Yeah, it seems like these things are, like, whoever has these things is basically going to win. Like, they're just indestructible.
Well, as we've seen in history, like, when the tank was first introduced, numbers beat novelty of equipment every single time.
That's a good point.
Yeah, on the one hand, you've got these four, like, next-generation indestructible combat frames, just a you know, traipsing about the countryside, leveling everything in their path, but they still need to be resupplied. They still will need maintenance, ammo.
The way you said that, it just, like, I just saw, like, the sound of music, but with giant fucking robots with lasers.
Me too. And that, riding his telepathy. Storytelling his telepathy. So good. That's as intended. But yeah, they've got, you know, a few billion people to deal with, right?
Yeah.
So is my geek
app. So eventually, if you throw enough people at this thing, it's kind of like the Imperial Guard tactic. It doesn't matter what anybody else brings. If we just throw a million Imperial Guardsmen down its throat, eventually we will clog its works.
Yeah, I mean, or a nuke. I mean, you can still take these things out with a nuke, but, I mean, the problem then becomes collateral damage.
Yeah, you know, do you really want a nuke, like, New York City just to get this one guy and his giant robot?
Yeah, and I mean, there's space rocks. You could use a mass driver just to drop a 2-kilometer asteroid on him. But again, then you create other problems. But, I mean, the Coalition's done it before, so they're not above that. So HLO still has to deploy their X-Seeds judiciously and select targets carefully.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, it's that balance between, you know, we want to do enough damage to hurt them, but we don't want to do enough damage to where they will justify dropping Australia on top of us.
Yeah, although that little wrinkle is somewhat ameliorated by the other thing, the real terror weapon for which the X-Seeds were just devised as, you know, the GPS systems of the rangefinders. That should give you some idea of the scale here, that these death bots I just spent 10 minutes describing to you in gory detail are glorified radar systems for something else.
Damn. Okay. Now you've definitely got my attention. I mean, you had my attention before, but now I'm starting to feel a little hot under the collar.
Yeah, and so
I can't imagine what the bigger thing is, and I'm really looking forward to getting a hold of the book so that I can find out.
Good, then I've done my job. Hopefully your listeners feel the same way. And I'm more than glad to give them a chance to read the book. So I urge everyone to back the Indiegogo campaign now. We get early access to the book as well as a bunch of crazy awesome perks. I'm adding more all the time.
Yeah, it looked like there were a couple more since the last time I checked it.
Outstanding.
So, yeah, where is it right now? You're up to almost 200% of the goal.
Almost.
And I'm looking at that fighter. I didn't see the pictures at first, but, you know, you mentioned that there was an example of the fighters up there. I'm looking at that. It reminds me of, like, when the Transformers went to Cybertron back in the 80s cartoon.
Yeah.
Yeah, they took on their real shapes instead of trying to hide with Earth technology. And, yeah, that looks like Starscream. That was the first thing that I thought of, was Starscream on Cybertron.
Well, Art Anon has done his job because that fighter actually is a Transformer.
Oh, really? So it's got a little bit of the Macross going on.
Yeah, you see the mech next to it with a similar color scheme.
Oh, the blue one?
Yeah, the green blue one.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah, I see the resemblance now. Yeah, that, oh god, this is gonna kick so much ass.
Yeah, yeah, fun story. So Art Anon designed the fighter config.
Mm-hmm.
And then Todd Everhart took that and said, okay, I'll hold my beer. And he broke the plane apart and said, okay, how do I use every part of this thing to make a robot? And he did.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
These guys are just genius. They should work together on, like, a fucking comic book or something.
They should, because watching the synergy between them has been just jaw-dropping, because, like, Art Anon will have an idea. Todd will be like, whoa, I really dig that picture. Well, what if we do this for the next one and come up with something just insane? And then Art Anon says, oh, I like that, but how about this? And then tops it, and they just go back and forth, and it's this feedback loop of awesome.
You probably could put, like, if you can get both of them to agree to it, you probably could put, like, a comic book at the big high tier. Just so you could pay for all of the art that it would take. But yeah, you probably could get a good couple of comic books out of this.
I'm still hoping to do it. I definitely plan to do more of these campaigns. And if we continue our growth, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the movie one day.
Yeah, I've had people come to me and say, man, dude, you need to get Sunrise to make like an 80s, 90s style anime out of this. You need to do at least a six issue OAV.
Oh,
six
yeah.
Episode. Yeah. Oh, just yeah, blow just, anything going today out of the water.
Just like an OVA, just for this. Like, you kick Gundam's ass all over the place.
Yeah, Ben Wheeler from Superversive SF, in his review, which you can read on Amazon, I encourage you to, storyboarded out the OP and EP for a speculative Combat Frame X Seed OVA, and it's mind-blowing. I mean, he nails all the highlights.
I'm going to have to go and check that out. I'm definitely going to have to go and check that out, because this is... There's so much potential here, but you're being very careful about how you're organizing things just to start out with. Like, this might get to like 15 books before it actually get. I mean, like, if there's not a Monster Hunter International TV show yet, I can't say whether or not this would have, you know, the same amount of popularity when you're at the same place that Larry Correa is right now, but. I have hope. I want to believe, put it like that.
Yeah, hope is the wishing for something with the expectation of receiving it.
It's a possibility. It is a possibility. So I won't count it out. I'll just admit that it's kind of like pie in the sky a little bit, but it's not out of the question within the next 20 or 30 years.
Well, I'm being patient. I'm being careful, and patience obtains all things. I mean, we'll probably have to wait for the current paradigm in television to go the way of the dodo, be replaced by something else, but...
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, I can't name a single studio or anyone, apart from, like you said, maybe Sunrise, or the guys behind Gurren Lagann, maybe, to handle something like this.
I mean, Larry aside, even Scalzi can't get a TV show made. Think of that.
Well, nobody would watch it, first off, but that's kind of...
Well, in fairness to him, they don't necessarily care about that, but he's not woke enough, amazingly.
Shockingly.
Yeah. But that's okay, because the more fiascos we have, like Last Jedi and the upcoming Captain Marvel, the more chances for disintermediation. And I mean, the barrier to entry for your average college kid with a red cam and a copy of Final Cut Pro is getting so low that just like with any publishing, we'll be able to do our own.
I mean, you've kind of always been able to do your own. Like, Evil Dead was made on a shoestring, you know, so it's possible to do it, but with something like this, it would require like at least CGI, if not, I would prefer practical effects, like, you know, stop motion, but that's also really expensive. So I don't know. We'll have to see where it's at in a few years, but right now it's looking up. It's definitely looking up with the amount of interest that you've got just, you know, off in our little corner of the internet. All it needs to do is break out and get to the rest of the people who like giant robot stuff.
Yeah. Something really needs to be done. I don't know. That's the problem. I mean, if we had an even playing field and guys like Jack Dorsey and Jeff Bezos weren't throttling dissenting creators, the sky would be the limit. But, no, I mean, I've been shadow banned on Twitter. I have good reason to believe that Google's throttled my blog traffic.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I mean, it's not just me. There are other guys who've gotten totally exiled from Light Society. So, I do know we need some kind of antitrust proceedings, some kind of executive order, Internet Bill of Rights, prosecute these guys as publishers under, I think it's Section 230 of like the Open Internet Act or something like that. Like, basically, back in the 90s, some folks in D.C. amazingly exercised some foresight. Like, this internet thing could really be big. We'd better protect it. And the idea was that, okay, if you're a publisher, like a newspaper publisher,
right,
then you're subject to libel laws depending on what you say. You know, you could get sued if you slander somebody.
Yeah, like if Saliza at CNN wrote an article about how Trump rapes babies or something, then, you know, lacking proof of that, he would be subject to, like, defamation and libel lawsuits.
Right, and what this act did was say, okay, we don't want, like, at the time, forums and message boards where users show up and are generating content. You know, we don't want the owners of those services to be to have legal exposure to, like, slander and libel. So that's why nowadays guys like Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey don't get dinged for, you know, hosting ISIS and stuff, or saying that Trump is a bedwetting Russian bot or something, right? Because this act gives them immunity from that as forms. And it was for the purpose of fostering lively and open public debate. But I think you can see the problem is that these social media platforms are not fostering open and public debate. They are censoring people and muzzling them and banning them.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not even about fostering it. It's about throttling it. Like, they don't have to go out of their way to, you know, say, you guys should come over to our website and have a discussion. I mean, it's not like Twitter needs any help getting people to use its platform. Well, now they do, because recent practices. But, like, a couple years ago, it's not like Twitter needed any help with getting people to use their platform. All they had to do was just sit there and be impartial, and if someone put up something that was actually illegal, like snuff or CP or something, just take it down.
And
report the people to the FBI. You know, and that's all they had to do. But no, they have to get involved.
Yeah, that was the impetus behind this law, which was, okay, as long as you guys just provide this forum and stay impartial and allow for free speech within reason, you won't be subject to libel laws like a publisher. But as any honest legal observer will tell you, they all long ago violated that law. They are directly curating content, which makes them publishers. So,
I mean, banning people like Roosh and Tommy Robinson and, you know, Jordan Peterson got his account, his Google account shut down for, like, I don't know, all of 10 minutes before people realized, oh shit, he's got a lot of money, he could sue us. And they put it back up really quickly. Or even Voxed Ape being silenced by Amazon. I think that happened for a while a couple of times.
Yeah. And that's the point. What Vox realizes too is these people only language they understand is lawfare. Like, you need to make a rubble bounce, you need to hurt them. Well, the government has all the lawyers and all the money. And by their own law, they really should be cracking down on Facebook and Twitter and Google and Amazon for violating this act, because these guys are behaving as publishers. By the act of doing, of censoring these people, of throttling people and banning them, they now become content curators. And they've even said as much. Like, they're like, well, we want to create a, you know, diverse and progressive and safe environment. Sorry, you're curating content now. You're not letting people show up and exercise their free speech.
Yeah.
So you can, they're having their cake and eating it too. But
the problem is they've got people in Washington in their pocket, which we saw with the Jack Dorsey hearing before Congress, I think, and, you know, when Zuckerberg went up there and looked like fucking Data from Star Trek.
Yeah, that was a chance for Congress to meet their bosses, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. Ask them some really tough, hard-hitting questions.
But the thing is, it doesn't have to come from Congress. The executive branch actually has quite a track record for trust busting. I mean, look at Taft and Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was about to say Roosevelt. So,
yeah, Taft actually did more.
Really?
Taft spent most of his presidency in the Supreme Court arguing antitrust cases. He was hardly ever in the White House.
I'm going to have to look into Taft. I don't really know. Like, he's one of those presidents that I never really looked into all that much.
Cool dude. He was our ambassador to the Philippines. But his lifelong ambition, total tangent here, but I love talking about this guy. He wanted to be a Supreme Court justice.
And, like, missed the mark so hard he wound up in the president's seat.
No, he eventually made it. He, I'm almost certain that after the presidency, because he was ambassador to the Philippines, vice president under Roosevelt, then president in his own right, and pretty sure he did finally get that seat on the bench on SCOTUS.
Wow. Yeah, I'm just sorry. I don't mind diverging like this because I'm a huge fucking history nerd.
Yep, he was the 10th Chief Justice of the United States. Sorry, he was Chief Justice, in fact.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, he had a quite a lot of power in his lifetime.
Yeah, he was basically checking off all the top spots. Vice President, done it. President, done that. Chief Justice, done that. Governor, done that.
Damn.
Hey, dude, it was a machine. It's crazy.
It would. I have to admit, it would be nice if Trump would leverage a little bit more of that power into not, you know, into taking these companies to task for censoring people, especially since, you know, the larger internet had a hand in him getting elected in the first place. People like Julian, like a big step would just be pardoning Julian Assange, but apparently he can't be bothered to do that.
Yeah, or Snowden or reinstating Alex Jones. Who's been just hurled into the void. But yeah, he needs to do something. We need an EO or some kind of antitrust lawsuit, or he's going to get crushed in 2020. I don't think he realizes it.
I don't know if it's that bad, but
it's that bad.
I do know that the news lies about him all the time. Like I say, I catch Hard Bastard's live streams whenever I can. He does news aggregation and commentary. And he shows videos from CNN and NBC and ABC and all these different places and articles from various different news organizations. And the amount of just lying, just like flat out, they'll have people get on and say things that are untrue, that they know are untrue. And that goes out to millions of people, you know, not just worldwide, but specifically in the American voter base that are just lying. Like the amount of people that think that Trump pissed on a bed in Russia in front of or got prostitutes to piss on a bed in Russia is frankly embarrassing. So I agree. It would behoove him to do something about this before shit gets out of hand.
Yeah, imagine think of 2016 and now take away Alex Jones, take away InfoWars, take away Ann Coulter, take away Milo, just all, you know, take away Stephen Molyneux, all the guys that were in the alternate media standing up for him. They're being picked off.
Slowly but surely.
Yeah, and they're going to ramp it up. I mean, the 2018 congressional elections were a dry run for it and had mixed success, but they're, you know, they only got one house, but they're constantly refining their methods.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's...
But yeah, that this diverged way too. I mean,
well, I'm going to bring it back because this kind of blatant propagandizing and technocratic manipulation is how you get the SOC, folks.
Not wrong.
It's how you get space nanny state dropping rocks on you.
Not wrong. You know, I look around and I'm very worried about pretty much the way that the country is going. Like, not just, you know, unfiltered immigration like the Democrats want, but, you know, just the way that like violence is being fomented by major media organizations, and, you know, that's going to require some kind of, because if the cops won't protect you like what happened at Berkeley, then you have to protect yourselves, which is what the Proud Boys did, and then they got hauled into court for it. And, you know, if defending yourself is a crime now, well, there's only so many ways that this can go.
Yeah, creating a large, mostly male underclass of people who just can never get a job again and can't have a bank account. Not really the recipe for stability.
Not really, no. That's not really good. Like, I don't know what they assume. All these people are just going to go away and die in a ditch somewhere. And that's like, if you look at history, that's not the way this kind of thing has ever happened at all.
Yeah, you want to know the scary thing? Mm-hmm. They're not thinking ahead. They're not arch political manipulators. You know, Bond villains, stroking a hairless cat and you know, that with a conspicuous scar. No, they are just kind they're of heretics.
Your average moron.
Yeah, they're zealots. They're motivated by religious sentiment. Hmm. Okay, by piety run amok, and
that's an interesting perspective, because I've been saying for a couple of years now that the SJW thing, it really does resemble a cult. Because I studied religion in college. You know, I know that's a weird thing for an atheist to go into, but you know, I studied religion in college, and I looked at all kinds of different religions. Like, there's certain tribes that believe that their ancestors' souls, when someone dies, their body goes into a fish, and they release the soul into the afterlife by catching, cooking, and eating the fish. And it could be any fish, but that's the one that had their dad's soul in it, or whatever. Or even groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses, or the Jonestown people, and things like that. It's very cult-like behavior. You can show them reality. And they will go ahead and deny it just flat out to your face. They will accept contrary propositions that you cannot hold at the same time and just wick away the cognitive dissonance like it wasn't even there, and go on about their day like all of their positions make sense. Like, for example, you have like Kamala Harris, who voted not to protect newborn babies from basically being neglected to death. In the hospital, essentially. And then she'll come on Twitter and talk about, you know, we have to protect these children at the border. We care about the kids at the border and everything. And it's like, you know, you get that these are two completely contrary positions to hold. And we can all see you. We can all see you holding these contrary positions. So it's very much like a religious fervor that they have, where they will just believe in all of this insane shit and not even really consider it.
It is. There was a UFO religion in Chicago in the 1950s.
Oh, I think I've heard of these guys. This wasn't the Heaven's Gate people, was it?
Wasn't Heaven's Gate, but I'm trying to look up their name right now. I know the leader claimed to be receiving messages from the planet Clarion.
Oh, this sounds so familiar.
Yeah, but they... Oh, let's see, is this it?
Turns out it was the fillings in his teeth picking up radio signals.
Yeah, the Seekers. The Seekers, led by Dorothy Martin.
Yeah, this does sound familiar, but...
Yeah, and she claimed that the world would end on December 21st, 1954, the stroke of midnight, but that the Guardians would send a mothership to pick up the faithful. Now, of course, that didn't end up happening, because we're still here.
Right.
But what do you think happened with Dorothy and the Seekers? Did they realize their beliefs were wrong and disband and go do something productive with their lives?
No, I misinterpreted the signals, and it's actually coming on this date, or, you know.
Right. The belief was only strengthened. So, yeah, that kind of resistance to disconfirmation you see from cultists is exactly what the modern left is doing. But they're taking it to another level, because not only are they just blatantly holding two contradictory positions at the same time, they don't care. They're doing it purposefully. It's like, it's now become like almost a liturgical rite or a form of burning your pinch of incense to do that.
Yeah, virtue signaling is kind of like their morning prayer.
Yeah, or on another level, these absurd hate crime hoaxes.
Those are really funny until they turn out tragic, like that one trans person that like burned their house down and killed like five pets in it, like their own animals. They just burned their own animals alive because apparently LGBTQ issues weren't being taken seriously enough, so I have to kill my pets and burn my house down and burn everything that I own to get people to take me seriously.
Yeah, not seriously. Jonah Goldberg actually had a good take on these hoaxes. He said, look, Jews and gypsies living in Nazi Germany didn't have to stage hate crimes. And if they did, when they were reported to the authorities, you know what the authorities would say? It's like, oh no, someone spray painted a swastika on my door. Yeah, and slam, right? No, the only reason that you fabricate hoax like this is because you know the powers that be will show you sympathy and take you seriously.
Yeah. Like, none of this would be necessary if it was actually happening. Like, if there were actually roving bands of magipedes running around Chicago, beating up black guys and pouring bleach on their faces and calling them homophobic slurs at 3 a.m. in negative 20, there wouldn't be any white guys in Chicago. The gangs would get together and just take them out. Like, it's not... If it was actually happening, they wouldn't need to fake it. And if it was actually happening, then all of these different hate crimes would... Because we live in this age where everything happens so fast. And as soon as something happens, everybody knows about it. Because everybody is connected to everybody else via, like, 18 orders of separation. But we're all still connected. So word spreads like wildfire throughout the internet. So if somebody had actually done that... then it would be very easy to find them. Like, I've seen SJWs on Twitter. Like, some 80, 90-year-old woman will be sitting next to a black person and tell them that they look nasty. And then it's immediately on Twitter. Like, they'll film that happening and then put it up on Twitter, and it's like, let's find this racist asshole and make her sorry. And they've got her name, her address, her children, her grandchildren, everything.
Yeah, that's why if... you're still like busily writing blog posts and articles, trying to understand the SJWs, or you're even worse, trying to convince them and reason with them, right? Like, as soon as you point out the 1,776th leftist inconsistency, the bald eagle named Freedom will swoop down and take you out to the libertarian paradise. No, exposing hypocrisy doesn't work. They don't care. They take pride in it.
Yeah, I kind of realized
they're not
this.
Rational.
I kind of realized this around the time, the 50th time I saw the wage gap debunked. And it's very easy to debunk the wage gap, but they just keep going and keep going and keep going, despite the fact that everybody knows it's bullshit.
Yeah, dude, loosen the bow tie. It's cutting off your head.
Yeah, exactly. So you're never going to get through to these people.
No,
and there are some people, like, I'm not going to say that all of that effort goes to waste, because there are some people out there who will be brought around by rational arguments and inconsistencies in their view of reality. There are those people, but they are a very small number, you know.
They're like 10%.
Yeah, like, Hard Bastard was a Jehovah's Witness, and he escaped from the cult because of things like that. Him and his buddy, who also runs HNN with him, there's still, like, how many people in the Jehovah's Witnesses, despite all of the inconsistencies that they see on a daily basis? You know, there's a lot of people out there that you're never going to be able to reason with.
Yeah, and that's where rhetoric comes in. And for a while there, during the meme wars, we learned how to engage with SJWs and win every single time, but they just... responded like the Russians did in the Napoleonic Wars in World War II. They just retreated to their safe space, then went scorched earth
on everywhere else.
Yeah, they burned down the territory we took. So yeah, they just retreat behind a block bot and get Jack to ban the offenders.
Mm-hmm. And like, so, like I say, it's not a hot war, it's not a shooting war, but it is a war. It's, you know, as much as I hate to use the cliche, it's an info war.
No, it is. It's a propaganda war. And again, talk about a cliche, but people need to wake up. Like, boomer cons and normies just... I know they don't want to wake up. I know the conditioning is strong. I know it contradicts a lot of what you've been told your whole life, but just everything is at stake. Because the thing is, SJWs don't want to win. They're toddlers seeking boundaries, right? They desperately, on a deep limbic level, want to be told no by an adult. But for some reason, we've arrived at a point where there are no adults in the room anymore.
Yeah. It's like that guy, I know you saw the video, the guy who kicked that chick in the face in, like, Ontario or whatever it was, at the abortion, anti-abortion rally. She was filming him, and he tried to kick her phone out of her hand, but he just, like, cocked back and kicked her right in the face. as soon as his foot made contact with her face and she hit the dirt, you hear him screaming, "I meant to kick your phone! I meant to kick your phone!" Like, he knew for a fact that this was going to be a problem. That somebody, an adult, was about to come down and punish him for that. He was about to get arrested. He was about to get charged. He knew that the law was coming. And it seems like that's the only way to, like, get through to some people like that. It's just, like, there have to be consequences for these actions. And if they're not, the spoiled kid is just going to continue to be spoiled.
Now, of course, I don't endorse violence. I'm trying to...
Oh, no, of course not. I'm not saying go out and shoot people or anything, or beat people up or nothing like that. I'm just saying there have to preferably legal consequences, where we have a court system and they are proven guilty in a court of law in front of a jury of their peers, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but that's a problem. We have a total leadership vacuum where just no one wants to be the guy where the buck stops. No one wants to take responsibility. No one wants to make a choice. Right? Nobody wants to stand up and say, "That's wrong, and you're going to have to take your medicine for it."
That, and when they do, they're immediately destroyed for it.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's
Alex Jones, Gavin McInnes, Milo Yiannopoulos, to an extent, Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, those guys aren't authorities.
No, they're not authorities, but I mean, whenever somebody stands up and says, "The buck stops here," they are taken to task for it.
Yeah, they are. And you know, what I'm talking about is our elites, okay, our ruling class, because counter Americanism propaganda, we do have one. We always have had. The difference was that the framers of our Constitution said, okay, you know what? Instead of having our elite be hereditary, we're going to give everybody a shot at the top. And that way it's a meritocracy, the cream rises, and the best and brightest of the lower class get a chance to be in charge. And it worked for a while, but somewhere along the line, our elites just became totally disinterested in noblesse oblige. And now they're so disconnected from us that they actually hate us. It's like Bill Maher was saying the other day, talking about the difference between the folks in the coastal megalopolises and the guys in flyover country. It's like, well, we have Chef Wolfgang Puck and they have Chef Boyardee.
Yeah.
Chortle.
You know, smug liberal laughter. It's not just them. Like, you see it in even when they're working with their own constituency, like that video of Dianne Feinstein. They had all of those kids jump her.
Yeah.
And it was a total political assassination moment. Like, this was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez acolytes trying to jump Dianne Feinstein and get the neo-lib out, just like end her fucking career with the left. And she just looks like she just despises them. Now, I understand that there is a little bit of taking out of context there, but I'm not about to sit here and defend Dianne Feinstein. But yeah, that's the attitude that she had towards these kids, just being arrogant and dismissive of their concerns and like, "I've been doing this for a long time and you don't know anything, so, you know, just let me handle it." And yeah, it's like she obviously thinks that she's better than them, even if she wasn't being as mean as the clipped videotape makes her look.
Right, but yeah, again, appearances are everything these days, and a lie can travel around the world before the truth gets its boots on. So, but then the truth is often muzzled by the willing accomplices in the mass media, so... Yeah, I mean, we can't trust internet gurus or even elected politicians to save us. The former don't have the power, and the latter just aren't interested. They decide it's someone else's problem. So what? If this country's going to hell in a handbasket, I won't live to see it. I got mine. You know, I got my nice paycheck from Google, right? So I'm living large.
Why bother getting involved when it's, you know, it can only hurt me.
Yeah. Our rulers no longer think it's worth it to raise a finger in anyone else's interest but their own. And again,
I mean, I've seen a couple of people like try and get their balls back. Like Ted Cruz has been doing very well since the 2016 election, since he lost the primaries to Donald Trump. He seems to have taken a couple of notes out of Trump's playbook. And after John McCain died, thank God, Lindsey Graham suddenly remembered that he has testicles.
He did, only to, I mean, Kevin, he was great, but then he found and ported forever war in the Middle East.
Yeah, and that pissed me the hell off, because I was actually starting to, help me, I was actually starting to like Lindsey Graham there for a minute during the Kavanaugh hearings, but then he had to turn around and, that fucking Dan Crenshaw guy who just got elected, the Marine with the
the big boss looking guy,
He, like, comes out with all of this great rhetoric and talk, and he looks like he knows what he's talking about, and he does really well on Saturday Night Live, and he looks like he's actually trying to create a bridge with these liberals who are, you know, just look down on people like him, but he's like, hey, I can take a joke, you should be able to take a joke too, let's sit here and joke about each other. And then he comes out and he's like, we can't pull out of the Middle East, we have to kill everybody, and I'm saying, what the fuck is wrong with you, man?
Well,
like, you were doing so well.
Was a politician anyway. Those are his true colors. He knows what side his bread is buttered on.
Oh yeah,
these guys know the score. It's just they're paid not to change anything.
I can believe it. I can believe it. I haven't seen any receipts, but I can absolutely believe it. Especially with the fact that they didn't swear like Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey in. When they brought them into those hearings, just we're gonna let you lie. It's fine. No legal reprisals. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Shameful.
Well, it is. Things are gonna get really interesting. Hopefully, not quite as interesting as in Combat Frame Exene, but the future has yet to be written, except in my book, which comes in detail and it's a lot of fun. You should get it.
Yeah. Wow, we went off for like a half fucking hour on that.
You'll have that.
Yeah. I definitely don't mind. I like discussing politics with people who are I don't want to say intelligent enough to understand it, because that makes me sound like a douche, but there's a lot of people out there that it's just not worth talking to them about it. You know, like, like I had this moment over Christmas with this guy on Twitter. It was about abortion, and I had said something to the effect of, this is obviously killing a child, you know, if it's not a human, then what is it? And he was like, well, all of the science says that it's not. And I just stopped and I was like, I'm not gonna get anywhere with this guy. Like, it doesn't matter what I say, he's still got that blinder up. So I'm just gonna say, look, I know we're not gonna get anywhere here, so I'm just gonna part ways right now, and I hope you have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And he was like, all right, same to you. And we just like kind of went our separate ways. And I think that might be the nicest interaction I've ever had on Twitter with somebody I didn't know. But it's just like, there's some people out there that it's just not worth talking to this stuff about, because you're going to be at loggerheads the entire time. You know, there's no compromise point. But like you and I disagree on certain things, and we can sit here and talk about it, like the whole like, is there a God thing. You're gonna outclass me on that because you're a theologian, but you know, we disagree about that, but we can sit here and we can talk about it, or we can talk about other things, and we can have a productive discussion like that. But certain people are just hostile, and it's not worth really getting into a conversation with them.
Yeah, it's again, it's that the immunity to disconfirmation. That guy was arguing from an article of faith. Because no, science doesn't say that. Science can't say that. It's not in the realm of science to classify what is and what is not a child. That's in the realm of philosophy.
Well, I mean, but I think it's in the realm of science, because it's a living being. Like, it's got its own DNA, it's got its own brain, it's got its own heartbeat, and if it's not a human life, then what is it? Is she growing a dog in her stomach? Like, you know, so it seems to me like science confirms the whole, like, it's a child. But, you know, I also see the philosophical argument for it.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Science, empirical science can provide grist for the mill of metaphysics, okay? It's a valid source of evidence, but getting from an is to an ought
Yeah, is that is definitely the purview of philosophy.
Well, right, it's like, hey, this is a human child, and it's immoral to kill it, right? That's
a step that's beyond science. Science is just meant to deal with, like, basic facts and, like, what is and what isn't in the natural world. It's not meant to be like, all right, so what should we do about these natural facts?
Yeah, because when we point out, like, oh, well, it's got its own, like, distinct DNA, then, you just got, like, a hand-waving, like, oh,
but it's not viable outside of the womb or something.
Yeah,
like that. People say that to me.
Yeah, so does another person. Or, like, if you get a liver transplant, so does the other person's liver. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, they fucking love science.
they love the science. Yeah, let's... because they keep telling us in every fucking Marvel comic that comes out ever.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about transgenderism.
Oh, boy. There's a fun discussion that won't get either of us blacklisted.
Nah, they're coming for us either way, but...
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I mean, thanks, I'm glad you have a good time talking to me. I've from experience, I am one of the 10% of the population who is capable of changing his mind based on new information, because I've changed my mind on many things a bunch of times.
Yeah, but, I try to not be intractable and actually look at the things that people are saying, but with some people it's just, like, I realize that I'm a hostile person, right? Like, I totally get that I'm a dickhole, especially on Twitter, but, you know, if somebody actually comes to me and wants to have a discussion, I'll have a discussion, but somebody like Kamala Harris, it's not worth sitting there and trying to talk to her because she's got a million people bartering for her attention, so why not just be snarky on Twitter and, you know, talk to other people about how dumb she is.
Fair enough.
So, was there anything else that you wanted to talk about with the book? I know you're not going to reveal the ending to me or anything like that. We do want people to read this thing, but was there any other points? I think we had left off on the super weapon that shall not be revealed unless you actually go and back to Kickstarter or buy it on Amazon once it comes out. But was there anything else that you wanted to reveal about it?
I think I'm going to keep any other info on the plot in reserve at this point. However, some publishing news.
Okay.
Yeah, as I revealed on the Superversive podcast the other day, originally I had said that my initial run of Combat Frame XE was planned for 4 books. Now, having gotten deep into the writing process of Coalition Year 40, a couple things became apparent. One, that to tell this story in the way that it deserves would require an ethereal-length tome. Right.
I'm sitting here just thinking, like, please say more books. Please say more.
All right, find more books. Let's cut to the chase. Yeah, I'm going to split Coalition Year 40 into 2.
Okay.
And then continue with Combat Frame XE S and Combat Frame XE double S. So there can be 5 total.
All right. So is the second part of Coalition Year 40, is that part of this Kickstarter, or are you going to do its own campaign for it?
I'm going to have to do its own, because one of the reasons I do the pay for the cover, and it's going to need a cover.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Also, you know, new opportunities for new trading cards and stuff like that. So.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I need to... there are some costs still involved in publishing, because being my own publisher, I have to accept all the responsibilities and costs that a publisher does. So, you know, formatting, editing, covers, advertising, so, you know, promotional art. So yeah, we're going to do one for that too. But I'm going to give my loyal backers a rest so you can save up some paychecks, save your pennies, your couch cushion change. You know, maybe go on a cigarette or beer fast, you know, buy one less pack or 6-pack a week. I don't know what we're going to need to do, but I'm going to give your wallet some time to recharge, because still got to finish this book. Got to get it released. Got to do the promotion on that. And then starting the next one. So luckily, I didn't realize there is a natural, perfect dividing line right in the middle of the story that will make a great natural ending point for Coalition Year 40, but it'll make it more of a kind of a downer Empire Strikes Back kind of to be concluded ending.
Oh, so a little bit of a cliffhanger there, like Han Solo is trapped in Jabba's palace and, you know, Luke gets his hand chopped off and finds out Vader's his dad and stuff like that.
Right. It comes at a low point in the character's heroic arc, but it's still a nice little punctuation mark.
Okay.
Where you still get a complete story with a complete beginning, middle, and end up to that point. And then the second half also is more of the rise from the low point, but it also has a complete beginning, middle, and end. Because novels are made up of multiple short stories starting together that each have their own beginning, middles, and ends. So it works out.
Yeah. I really have to say, now that I've started like taking the craft of writing seriously, now that I'm reading with an eye to how people structure their stories, it really is gratifying to find somebody like Johnny Boyle, who wrote Queen's Heir. Like, when you go and read that book, each chapter of the book reads like its own short story. It's not like, oh, this is the setup for the next chapter, because every chapter is the setup for the next chapter. It's that old, right. That old Jack Ketchum thing. The first sentence is meant to get them to read the first paragraph, and then the first paragraph is meant to get them to read the second paragraph, and on until you have chapters and so on and so forth. But it's nice when you could just take a chapter out of a book and put it up online and say, this is a cool story, and there's more of it.
Right, and that's how it's done.
You know, and it's really interesting to see how different authors do that and how they structure their chapters. And I'm kind of trying to get into that as well. I'm working on this this one story. I'm actually doing the thing that you and Adam Smith and a bunch of other people have recommended to me, and doing an outline for it. So I'm kind of trying to structure each chapter as its own little short story that tells this bigger story of this, like, Punisher-style Mr. A vigilante, this Rorschach-type character who's not insane. He actually has, like, a morally... I'm not going to weigh the book down with philosophy and everything like that, but he actually does have a morally justified reason for going around and killing all of these, like, murderers and rapists and gang members and stuff like that.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, I really do have to thank you guys for for hooking me up with the secret sauce of the outline.
Well, on behalf of all of us, it's our pleasure. And I know that me and all those guys not only find it enjoyable, but an obligation to help up new aspiring authors. Godspeed.
And on behalf of the new and aspiring authors, we sure as shit appreciate it.
Good.
So was there anything else that we needed to go over before we kind of wind things down? Or
I think I'm good. I actually got to get back to work providing you guys with more quality entertainment.
All right, that sounds like a plan. Well, thank you again for coming on the show. I'm definitely looking forward to the new book, man. Good luck with the Indiegogo.
Thank you.
And remember, everybody, link is in the description. Go check it out for all of your modern mech needs that aren't just retreading the fucking Xeon War for the 30th time.
Is that what we're up to? Wow.
Is it? I think so. I think there's been, like, what, like 30, 40 Gundam series?
Yeah, why not?
But, all right, yeah, we'll go ahead and kill it here. Thanks again for coming on the show, man. It's always fun talking to you.
Xeon did nothing wrong.
I believe they didn't. All right, everybody. We'll catch y'all next week. Don't forget, go check out Brian's books, and there'll be a link to his blog in the description if you want to check out his Soul Cycle series and various other works that he's done. But, yeah, all right. I'll talk to you later, Brian.
Good night.
Night. All right, well, that was the podcast, everybody. Thanks again to Brian for coming on the show to promote his new books. And be sure and go check out his blog and his Indiegogo campaign for Combat Frame XSeed Coalition Year 40. Now, I'm going to go ahead and do the sponsors and get out of y'all's hair. I think we've taken up quite enough of your time just rambling. So, without further ado... If you like what I do here and you want to help me out, there are a few ways that you can do that. The first up is you can go buy your copy of Dimension Bucket Magazine, Volume 1 from Gumroad. It is not up on Amazon yet, to my knowledge. I will talk to Christopher Warren about that. But it is up on Gumroad, and you can find it over there for $5, and they have various different formats, like documents and PDFs and that kind of thing. So you can choose how you want it downloaded, and all of those come standard when you actually buy the magazine. I'm not sure if Gumroad gives you multiple downloads, but I can't see any reason why they wouldn't. But yeah, I do have a story in there. It is a kind of horror science fiction fantasy story set in the swamps of Louisiana, dealing with snake people and an organization that has devoted themselves to protecting what's left of the Confederate States post-Civil War, normal United States history timeline post-Civil War, by the way, from fantastical and wondrous threats like snake people who want to summon a dark god and bring about the end of the world. So that's a good story that you can find over there if and you want, along with all of the other great fiction and nonfiction that we've collected for this magazine. You can see the amount of talent that we have just from the names on the cover. So $5, great fiction, great nonfiction, can't beat that deal with a stick. Next up, we have the Planetary Earth Anthology by Superversive Press. I have a story in this book as well. It is about a couple of guys who get trapped in a lost world situation on the Antarctic continent where people ride dinosaurs and there are alien creatures running around, and they get into a chase on velociraptors with a Tyrannosaurus Rex. I enjoyed it, and John DeLaRose said that he enjoyed it too. So if that sounds like an endorsement to you, it sounds like an endorsement to me. So go and pick that one up if you want to help me out with that. I do still get royalties off of that. I have a Ko-fi. If you want to be more direct about it and just toss me a couple of shekels, you can do it over there. Should be a link on the blog. I have done books 6, 7, and 8 in the Cat Kimbridge Chronicles series, the audiobooks for them. So if you are into military science fiction with a strong main character who is also a woman, I saw Paul Varghavis talking about this today on Twitter. It shouldn't be strong female character. It should be strong character who is also female. So if you want a strong character who is also female, along with various alien races that this man has made up of whole cloth with some great, great dialogue and setting writing and things like that, really well fleshed out universe, I highly recommend this series of books. And you don't have to start at book 1. I didn't. I started at book 7. But I enjoyed book 7 and 8 so much that I went ahead and bought the rest of the audiobooks for them and listened to them. And enjoyed them greatly. So yeah, if that sounds like it's your thing, go and check those out. There are links on the right-hand side of the blog. Next up, we have the Dimension Bucket Media Books. This includes the magazine, but the magazine's kind of its own little project. Now we have Three Little Snowmen by Timothy Willard. We have The Phoenix on the Sword by Robert E. Howard. We have Darkest of Dreams, Hell's 5-Minute Tales of Horror, and various other books that we have put out and are looking to put out in the future. We also have The Showers by Dylan Sindelar. So if you enjoy horror stories, this is the place that you want to go for all of the best new up-and-coming indie horror. Next up, we have Aaron Clary, Captain Capitalism himself. He is a former banker and economist who blogs at captaincapitalism.blogspot.com. I recently listened to my old podcast the other day, and I had misspoke on that one. It's .blogspot.com, captaincapitalism.blogspot.com. And he has a consulting business that he runs at assholeconsulting.com. So if you have questions about life, the universe, and everything barring medical and legal advice, you can take it to Aaron, and for a fee, he will give you the straight dope. Aaron also has several books out, a few of which I've done the audiobooks for. Most recently, I did Poor Richard's Retirement, which is a treatise on how it is possible to achieve retirement in today's economic environment via minimalism. A lot of good information in that book. I also did Enjoy the Decline, Accepting and Living with the Death of the United States, which is a book about how to properly gear yourself up mentally for the coming decline of the country. And I also did Reconnaissance Man, which is about how you shouldn't jump immediately out of high school into college. You should take a couple of years, earn some money, figure out where you want to live and what you want to do and where is the best place to do that, and then follow your dreams instead of getting laden down with $100,000 of student debt like a bunch of other, you know, fucking idiots. point it myself here. take my word for it. If I had had this book in high school, I would be in far less debt than I am right now, so far as student debt goes. So go ahead and pick that one up. He also has Curse of the High IQ, which is for those of you who feel that you might be smarter than the average bear, and you're having some trouble adjusting to normie society. This book is built to help you cope with the various personality problems and issues that you might have by having a higher than average IQ. Next up is John E. Boyle. John is the author of the excellent novel Queen's Heir. That's H-E-I-R, as in the heir to the queen, not the heir that the queen breathes. It is a fantasy, a sword and sorcery set among the Hittites at the end of the Bronze Age, which is not a scene that I see a lot of authors tackling very often. And he does it very, very well. I'm still working on the audiobook. He wants me to get in, to get in contact with him about it, and I am going to email him. But the audiobook should be coming out fairly soon here, hopefully, depending on what we need to do to get it to his standards. But it is an excellent book, and it has everything that you could ask for in a sword and sorcery novel, including swords and sorcery. There are ghosts, demons, giant armies clashing, travel. It's got fantastical sights, big cities, countrysides, fantastical races like elves and certain ones that he created on his own, to my knowledge. It has dragons. It's a very, very well put together and well worked out book. He really did his research on the cultures of these areas and the technology that they would have and things like that. It's very well written, and I highly recommend that you guys go and pick it up if that sounds like your bag. Next up, we have the affiliate accounts. The way that the affiliate accounts work are you click the button, you go to the website, you buy whatever you want, you don't pay anymore, and it doesn't cost the seller anymore out of their profits, but the website that you are using to facilitate this transaction is going to give me a kickback out of their profits of your transaction for sending you over there. So first up is Amazon. If you have any shopping that you want to do on Amazon.com, get some of these amazing books that I've been telling you about or various other projects. I know that Brian Niemeyer has several books out on Amazon right now. Then I would appreciate it if you would go to my blog first, jimfear138.blogspot.com, and click on the Amazon affiliate link, and then do take care of all your shopping, and you'll be helping me out. You'll be getting some cool stuff, and you'll be helping Amazon out. Not that they really need any help, but the principle is the same. Next up, we have mycomicshop.com. This is your one-stop shop for all things comic books. If you are interested in old, used, new, big two, indie, basically anything that's not on Indiegogo right now, you should be able to find on mycomicshop.com. I've been using this service for years, and I've never had a problem with it. They always get me my comics on time and undamaged in very nicely worked out protective packaging. So I highly recommend their service, especially if you're looking for some more obscure comics like I usually am, because I'm a fucking hipster douche like that. But if that sounds like something that you would be interested in, go ahead and check them out. There's a link on the left-hand side of my blog. Next up is Right Stuff Anime, which is kind of like mycomicshop.com for weebs, but it deals more with current things, so they don't necessarily have something that's been out of print for a while that somebody is just selling out of their garage, but they will hook you up with stuff that is currently running or is incredibly popular and still in print. If it's in print, they probably have it. So, you know, your Dragon Ball Zs, your Cowboy Bebops, your Goblin Slayers, your Overlords, that kind of thing. They also have DVDs and Blu-rays and various other products as well, including hats, t-shirts, jackets, body pillows, Nendoroid figurines, Gundam figurines, the 1/8 titty figurines. They also sell porn. If you're into paying for porn, you can pay for porn over there. Why you would, I have no idea, but they sell it. So if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, check out rightstuffanime.com. Stuff with one F, but you can find them on the affiliate link on the left-hand side of my blog. Next up there is advertising on the blog. If you would like to advertise on the blog, it is $20 a month. Get in touch with me via the contact form on the left-hand side of the blog, and we will get it worked out. This comes with a post on the blog about your thing, a banner ad on the blog about your thing for a month, various postings on my social media accounts over the course of the month to promote your thing, the valuable ones at least, the ones that I still use. I haven't touched my Tumblr in a long fucking time, so it probably wouldn't do any good to put something there. And I will also do a audio and, if you want, a visual advertisement for you that you could fit into your podcast feed. I will put it in mine. And you could put it up on your YouTube, your Vimeo, your BitChute, your BitTube, I guess. I don't know what all of the video streaming sites out there are, but if you want, I will make you one, and you can put it up there, all for $20 a month. A lot of value. Get in touch. We'll get your thing promoted. And lastly is a Bandcamp. The Bandcamp is where I'm putting all my independent narration. So if you want to hear what I can do without high quality master, just my regular quality, without the high quality mastering of Dimension Bucket Media, then that's the place to do it. I've got a couple of old horror stories up there, including The Haunter of the Ring by Robert E. Howard, and The Judge's House by Bram Stoker, as well as some old creepypastas from like 2014 and back when I was still doing those. Those were anonymous ones, though, so I'm not worried about anybody coming and calling, but we'll see how that goes. But they are up there, so yeah, you can go and pick those up. Once again, you'd be helping me out. But that's it. That's it, everybody. Links are in the description for all of Brian Niemeyer's things. Be sure to support his Indiegogo, and I will catch you guys next week. Peace out.